Want a woman to talk to me suggestively. Want to hear her say she'll be with me tomorrow morning, drinking hot jasmine tea. Want her to make me laugh, make a point of touching me when she talks, leaving all the jealous men in the joint to mumble in the beer and gunk. I know it only happens when I'm napping, nodding in a reverie. Did I find myself a woman who wouldn't mind seducing me? I know it only happens when I'm napping, nodding in a reverie. Did I find myself a woman who wouldn't mind seducing, starting from the moment that we've been introduced? I'd like to find a woman who wouldn't mind seducing me.
Cajun moon, where does your power lie as you move across the southern sky? You took my babe way too soon. What have you done, Cajun moon? Someday, babe, when you want your man and you find him gone just like the wind, don't trouble your mind, whatever you do, 'cause Cajun moon took him from you. Cajun moon, where does your power lie as you move across the southern sky? You took my faith. What have you done, Cajun moon?
Hi, this is John Lodge of the Moody Blues, and you're listening to my rocking attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie, on WRCT, Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
Just beginning to see Thank you. Riding the Crazy Horse, Neil Young from the Americana album. Oh, Suzanne, a little different version than I learned when I was in grade school. Going out to Scott in the North Hills. John Lodge from his new album, My Sojourn. That was a redo, a great redo, great cover of the Moody's Tuesday's Gone. Love that symphony in the background. Going out to Chris in New Kensington, he's listening online at WRCT.org. He won some Poco, and going back to 1983 from the Cowboys and Gentlemen album. That was a cover of J.J. Cale's Cajun Moon. And we open it all up with this week's guilty pleasure, courtesy of Wayne in Lawrenceville, Leon Redbone with Seduced. So this final half hour of Quartz in Session is brought to you by our friends at Sidecar Bakery. In North Oakland, Sidecar is an independent coffee shop with a full coffee bar, ready-made breakfast sandwiches, pastries, savory hand pies, cakes, and more in the bakery next door. Sidecar offers a place to study, eat, hang with friends in a cafe setting, open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday and 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday. For more information, you can visit their website at sidecar412.com. Sidecar Bakery, our sponsor for the final portion of tonight's show. So when I moved to Pittsburgh, I learned a lot of things. I learned about redding up. I learned about tennies and pop. And I learned about this next guy who is absolutely terrific. You want to have a good day, you can need a little Donnie in your life. This is Donnie Iris. I Want You Back.
I didn't mean to treat you like an orphan. This time Geronimo in jail down south, where he couldn't look the gift horse in the mouth. Sergeant, Sergeant, don't you feel there's something wrong with your automobile? Warden, Warden, listen to me. Be brave and set Geronimo free. Governor, Governor, isn't it strange you never see a car on the Indian range? Oh, boys, take me back. I want to ride in Geronimo's Cadillac. Oh, boys, take me back. I want to ride in Geronimo's Cadillac.
Oh, boys, take me back. I want to ride in Geronimo's Cadillac. Oh, now, take me back. I want to ride in Geronimo's Cadillac.
Take me back, I want.
That's new music from the band Initial Kick. Track was called Sloan Road Kids, and the album is called Plays with Mercury, right here in WRCT. I'm your rockin' attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie. That set of music, start off with some Donny Iris, I Want You Back, the latest compilation album, and it is fantastic, from the band Josephus. The compilation is entitled Call Me Animal. It's all covers of MC5 songs. And you heard Human Being Lawnmower with Jello Biafra and Wayne Kramer, original guitarist from the MC5. And then that was followed by one of my favorites, Johnny Rivers, Geronimo's Cadillac. So we started off tonight's show talking about how Buddy Guy is coming to town to the Palace Theater this Sunday night. We kicked off the show with some Buddy Guy. We're going to close the show with some Buddy Guy. Great tune called Blues Don't Lie. So I want to thank you for tuning in. I want to remind you that this Sunday night at 11, you can hear a replay of tonight's show right here on 88.3 FM. You can also hear it coming at you out of the West Coast in half an hour at 1033WWRO.com. So at this point, guys, it's time. Courts in session is now. Courts adjourned. Let's get back together next Thursday night at 8. Want to remind you, take care of each other, be kind to each other, and be proud to be American. Good night, Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I know. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Kevin Amos, and you're listening to Ebony Spectrum here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
A handful of rare audio recordings of interviews conducted with formerly enslaved Black Americans is shedding new light on the brutality of slavery and racial injustice in America.
Yeah, and ABC's Alex Perche learned more about these recordings from two key scholars of the ambitious 10 Million Names Project. And a warning here, of course, the subject matter is upsetting.
I want you to tell me how you got your name.
I got my name from President Jeff Davis, the President of the Southern Confederacy. He owned my grandfather and my father. My grandfather was a blacksmith, and my father had learned how to write a little bit in Richmond, Virginia before he brought him down there.
You're listening to the voice of a formerly enslaved American, a man by the name of George Johnson. This rare and historic audio interview was recorded in 1941, almost 80 years after Mr. Johnson gained his freedom. He and his family worked on a plantation in Virginia owned by Confederate leader Jefferson Davis, a staunch opponent of abolition. In the interview, Johnson recalls a day in the life as an enslaved person.
Did they drive the slaves down there in Davis's Bend very hard, or did they work them reasonable?
Reasonable. You know, Marston Jewel gave my chance another boy. And the boy was chopping cotton. Boy didn't kill, but you gang, you understand? He come to whip the boy, kill, you understand? That's the house of Marston Jewel, boy. And that's what's the trouble, son. Say, Mr. Stone don't whip me because I don't kill the gang.
Audio tape interviews like this are striking and uncommon, but are actually part of a long legacy of black families, communities, and institutions, including historically black colleges and universities, that lead the way in collecting and preserving the oral histories of the formerly enslaved people in the 19th and 20th centuries. In the 1930s and beyond, technology allowed some of these interviews to be recorded as part of both federal and independent projects.
Do we know roughly like how many of these recordings exist?
The recordings are relatively rare, but the recordings come from a much larger and really important and in many ways unsung collecting effort.
In 1974, a woman named Celia Black, at the age of 114 years old and shortly before her death, recalled picking cotton in Texas as a child born into slavery.
I didn't have to pick cotton or nothing.
I've been doing nothing but licking the field. Licking the field, oh goodness. Me and my husband would go, I'd west and pick cotton. Go out west every year. We live in this year going out there picking cotton.
One of the things that kind of struck me, you have an interview recorded in 1974. For some black Americans, I mean, they're one generation removed from slavery.
In some ways, we think of slavery as ancient history. We think of it as something that happened a very long time ago to people we couldn't possibly have known.
Dr. Kendra Field, chief historian of the 10 Million Names Project, and Harvard professor Vincent Brown explained how these recordings illustrate an enormous preservation effort. The firsthand accounts shedding light on the darkest chapters in our American history, yet also revealing incredible African-American strength and survival.
Didn't you have some entertainment, doing any dancing or anything?
Oh, I used to dance, but I don't do it now. No, I don't dance now. I try my best to serve my master. I'm trying my best to serve my heavenly Father.
You hear these recordings. What were the emotions when you hear, you know, the recollections of Celia Black?
First is just the miracle of her survival. It's just that I'm actually hearing this person who had been enslaved. That's kind of a miracle.
With the help of the 10 Million Names genealogist, we were able to find the direct descendants of Celia Black.
Yeah.
In Rhode Island, we met 68-year-old Curtis Royal, who spent time with her as a young man.
She's my great-grandmother. From my mother's side of the family.
Do you remember any of the stories that she would tell?
She told us about how difficult it was, you know, just being alive during that period.
We had a chance to know your great-grandmother.
Yes.
How powerful is it being able to connect that dot?
It's extremely powerful. You got to hear it from her directly. Not something that was passed on, but hear it directly from her pain.
Wow, that firsthand testimony.
Unbelievable. And I don't need to tell you, those firsthand accounts are just so important in connecting us to all of our ancestors and our collective American history. Of course, thank you, Alex, for that moving report. But to hear those audio recordings.
And as they said, every voice is a miracle in that situation. And to learn more, scan the QR code on your screen to visit our newly launched ABC News 10 Million Names digital landing page.
400 years have passed since America's original sin, and still, riots are ignited in the friction between race and justice. As this debate continues, the Smithsonian is completing a monumental project, the $500 million National Museum of African American History and Culture. The idea was authorized by an act of Congress, which called it, quote, a tribute to the Negro's contribution to the achievements of America. The words are jarring because the act was written in 1929. Building the museum has been a long struggle, just like the story it hopes to tell.
Beside the monument to Washington, a slaveholding president, the museum is breaking free of the ground on the mall's last 5 acres. 8 decades after Congress framed the museum on paper and then failed to fund it, the dream is being written this time in steel and stone. 10 floors, 5 above ground, 5 below. Its complexion rendered in shades of bronze, a building of color against history's white marble.
You've been at this 9 years now. It's a big job.
Well, as I tell people, at 8 o'clock in the morning, I have the best job in America. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, it's the dumbest thing I've ever done in my life. This is a Romare Bearden from the 1950s.
Sleepless nights are all in a day's work for the museum's founding director, Lonnie Bunch, a scholar of the 19th century.
Clearly, this ought to be one of those moments where people are going to sort of reflect, pause. What does it mean once we open? What does it mean in terms of development opportunities?
In 2003, President Bush signed the law creating the museum. Congress put up $250 million, and Bunch has raised most of another $250.
I knew that this is where this museum would have to be, that this is America's front lawn, and this is the place where people come to learn what it means to be an American, and this museum needs to be there.
So we're on the ground floor. This is where the visitors will come in. This will be their first experience in the museum. So what's going to be here?
They will walk in either from the mall or from Constitution Avenue, and they will run into amazing pieces of African-American art.
When all of this is finally complete, what will America have?
America will have a place that allows them to remember. To remember how much we as a country have been improved, changed, challenged, and made better by the African-American experience. They'll have a place that they can call home, but they'll also have a place that will make them change.
But even this place is only space until you fill it.
Oh, my goodness. Now, did somebody already look at some of these things?
No. No?
7 years ago, the Smithsonian began rummaging the attics and basements of America.
This may have marked a milestone in his life, and what we don't know is what
but
that was.
But at least it gives me something that I can investigate.
3,000 people brought their family history to 16 Smithsonian events across the country.
And this is an early free black family based out of Baltimore.
Yes.
It sounds like Antiques Roadshow.
It is like Antiques Roadshow.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Elliott and Nancy Burkaw are curators.
We have experts from across the museum field, experts in conservation, experts who understand about paper, about metals, about you name it, fabrics, textiles. And they come in and they review objects for the public.
The coating on this is in pretty good condition.
Some of that looks like it's dried out a little bit.
And don't put it near the air conditioning unit because that'll dry it up too much.
How do you convince someone to give up a priceless family heirloom?
Do you know what our museum pitches itself? All we have to do is tell the absolute honest truth. People have been waiting for us. People in America have been waiting for this moment. And so literally they just hand us things.
And we're very excited like you are.
Thousands of relics were examined, but only 25 will be in the collection. This is one of them.
This was actually a connection we made with the family. Mr. Jesse Burke was an enslaved man, and he was charged with playing this violin and entertaining the slaveholder and his guests.
This is the Smithsonian's warehouse in Maryland where the story is being written, and these are a few of the lines. Received by Grigsby E. Thomas, the sum of $350 in full payment for a Negro boy by the name of Jim, about 10 years old, this 31st day of December, 1835. Jim would have been familiar with these, shackles dating before 1860, bondage that might have been broken if the keeper of this Bible had succeeded in his bloody rebellion. Nat Turner had said that God commanded him to break the chains. His Bible was taken away before his execution. Paul Gardullo is a leader of the curating team.
I think many of us who know the story of slavery know about Nat Turner. Know about Nat Turner from the perspective of perhaps a freedom fighter, perhaps a murderer. Well, we know this is a religious person. We know this is a person who can read. And when you begin with that and those ideas, suddenly the person of Nat Turner and your understandings of Nat Turner take on a whole new light. And I look to do that again and again, ways that we can see well-worn stories, stories we think we know, in a new light.
You may think you know the story of a boy murdered for whistling at a white woman until you're confronted with his casket.
The story of Emmett Till is a crucially important story in terms of what it tells us both about sort of reinvigorating the civil rights movement, but also it's a story of his mother, Mamie Mobley, who was really one of the most powerful people who said that her son's murder should not be in vain, that it should help to transform America.
No one was punished for the murder of Emmett Till. His body was exhumed in a later investigation, and the original casket was neglected.
But then the question was, would we ever display it? Should we ever display it? And I wrestled a lot with it, but then I realized I kept hearing Mamie Mobley in my head, and she said, I opened this casket to change the world, to make the world confront the dangers, the power, the ugliness of race in America.
A lot of the things that you intend to put on display are going to be hard to look at.
What I'm trying to do is find the right tension between moments of sadness and moments of resilience.
One resilient moment came out of the blue. Air Force Captain Matt Twy and his wife Tina rebuilt an old crop duster, and in curiosity, they sent the serial number to an Air Force historian.
And he said, are you sitting down? Because I have some news for you.
Turned out the 1944 Stearman had trained America's first black squadrons, the Tuskegee Airmen, who flew to fame in World War II.
I had never really known much about the Tuskegee Airmen. I'd seen the P-51 plane, but I'd never really truly understood what it meant.
Take your time.
Before donating the plane, known as a PT-13, the Quais carried the last of the airmen back to the air.
And it was just great to sit back in the back seat and look at this real Tuskegee Airman in a real Tuskegee airplane. It's just magical.
The greatest thrill in my life was sitting in the seat where you are and watching the ground drop off from under it.
The PT-13 was the baby we used to learn how to fly.
The Smithsonian collected the thoughts of Lieutenant Colonel Leo Gray in 2010.
And they said we couldn't fly, but we had the best record of any fighter group in the 15th Air Force and probably in the Air Force itself. We stayed with our bombers, we brought them home as best we could, and we proved that we could fly.
The story will continue after this.
Time is the enemy of history, so Smithsonian conservationists have been working for years restoring America's heritage, from textiles to trains. This 1920 rail car had two sections, white and colored, the same number of seats, but colored was compressed in half the space. Physical, touchable, Jim Crow confinement, just like the guard tower from the prison in Angola, Louisiana, notorious for cruelty.
It's about 21 feet tall. This is cast concrete, so it's an enormous object.
From monumental to minuscule, Carlos Bustamante is the project manager building a place for 33,000 moments in time.
So when you have the rail car pieces, the guard tower, and all the support equipment, we had a convoy of about 12 semi-trucks traveling down the road across six states to get here. And it took them about 3 days.
How do you get those things into this building?
So we set up two very, very large cranes. And these cranes are rare. There's not a lot of them this size. And we picked up these two objects and basically brought them over the site and lowered them down about 60 feet below grade.
The answer is you don't move these objects into the building. You put these objects in place and you build the building around them.
Exactly. There's no other way.
Oftentimes what I'm drawn to are some of the smaller things. Shards of glass that were picked up after the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. And it's finding the balance between the big and the small, Scott, that makes this work a challenge and so wonderful.
What is something that you desperately want and have not been able to find?
I want Willie Mays' mitt.
Which would be quite a catch to display along with Louis Armstrong's horn and Chuck Berry's horn behind the chrome of his 73 Cadillac. There's the welcome of Minton's Playhouse, which resonated to Miles, Monk, and Dizzy. Ali's headgear, pristine condition. And this fireman's headgear, a revolutionary invention in 1914 by mechanical genius Garrett Morgan.
Do you think the country's ready for this now?
I don't think America's ever ready to have the conversation around race based on what we see around the landscape, whether it's Ferguson or other places, that people are really ready to shine the light on all the dark corners of the American experience. But I hope this museum will help in a small way to do that.
This is not the American Museum of Slavery.
This is not the museum of tragedy. It is not the museum of difficult moments. It is the museum that says, here is a balanced history of America that allows us to cry and smile.
Their emotions, experiences. So notions of joy, you may hear a screech, a howl. Feelings of sadness, you hear moans.
In African work songs, singing set the pace and reduced the monotony of work. This combination, dense textures, complex rhythms, and a community bound together by music while celebrating individual expression is unique in the world. Over the course of three centuries, nearly 11 million enslaved Africans survived the brutal Atlantic crossing. Now bound but not broken, African music lived on in the souls of these people.
You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul. You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul.
Africans in America continued their African traditions.
Music is a part of a person's or a culture's identity. And music is not simply something you leave behind, it travels with you.
In the colonies of North America, the lives of Africans varied from region to region, and their music began to evolve in different ways. In the North, the enslaved population was sparser, often living singly or in small groups in the slaveholder's house or in nearby cabins. In these close quarters, the Africans were forbidden to use their traditional forms of religious expression.
The missionaries and other whites felt compelled to impose their own Christian views.
In Philadelphia, black worshipers founded their own church. They were now free to express spirituality in their own ways, through music that came to be known as spirituals.